Why do more media professionals read iwantmedia.com? iwantmedia.com features reports from industry leaders and media personalities. iwantmedia.com gives you quick access to news, stats, trade orgs, and industry publications, and it's updated daily. Forbes says iwantmedia.com contains everything media professionals need to stay ahead of the game. The Washington Post calls it the source for the serious media geek. Do you get it? If you don't, you should. To sign up for free daily email alerts, visit iwantmedia.com.
Welcome to The Advertising Show, America's only radio program focusing on advertising, media, marketing, product development, branding, new media, sales and customer relations. Stay with us for entertaining marketing discussion and our special guest interview. Now, here are your hosts, Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe.
Thanks so much for making The Advertising Show a part of your day here. It's Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe on The Advertising Show, being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. You can visit them online at adage.com.
Today's podcast is brought to you by audible.com, where you'll find over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or your MP3 player. And just for you, our listeners at The Advertising Show, Audible is offering a free audio download, along with a free 14-day trial to give you guys a chance to check out their service. So audible.com is available for many of the business titles, authors that you've seen and read about here at The Advertising Show, as well as current releases from the New York Times bestsellers, arts and entertainment, fiction, nonfiction, all of the categories you would expect to find at your local bookstore are available at audible.com. To get your free audiobook download and begin your free 14-day trial, simply go to audiblepodcast.com/adshow. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/adshow. And sign up today. And while you're at it, tell a friend about The Advertising Show's free 14-day trial offer.
So there's no disclaimer on that. You put your announcer hat on for that one. That was very interesting.
Well, you know what's interesting? We have listeners around the world, and a few weeks ago you were talking about an offer that someone made, and they got overwhelmed with response and got himself in a tight squeeze.
Yes,
this is
Groupon.
This is not limited. Come one, come all.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
It's coming out of your pocket, pal, that's for sure.
Any overflow will come out of your pocket.
Oh,
yes.
Good. Thank you very much. The Advertising Show, a copyrighted Big Radio Midgets production. Hey, we've got a great show for you today. We've got Jay Green. Jay is an author, amongst other things as well, for more than a couple of decades. He has written about some of the most important companies, business trends, and top executives in the world. From 2000 to 2009, he served as Business Week's Seattle Bureau Chief, overseeing the magazine's coverage of the Pacific Northwest, which gave him the opportunity to cover design just as it was emerging as one of the key business strategies of the 21st century. The book is called, here we go, boys and girls, Design is How It Works. And we're happy to have Jay on the show today. We'll talk with Jay here in just a few moments, too. And let's see, we've got Jeremy Kent, our European correspondent. And apparently, not only in the United States, but in Britain, and I want to say even more so in Britain, but I guess maybe I shouldn't say that, breakfast seems to be a big sore point for our kids and the folks that are dishing out the cereals and the sugar, or the, as they call it, shoveling the sugar, are in a little bit of trouble. And Jeremy has a feature about that as well today here in a few moments on The Advertising Show. What you got there, Brad?
Sugar's a problem in Great Britain as well.
Oh, gosh,
yes.
Yeah. Huh? Oh, yeah, big time.
Yeah. Apparently, this past summer, Ray, even though we're still in it, summer movie attendance fell to its lowest since 1997, while soaring ticket prices produced record-level revenue for Hollywood studios. According to a reporter from Hollywood.com, when you raise prices and perceive that quality goes down, you have a major problem. Well, I guess so. But on the other hand, when you raise your prices, even though your ticket sales are down, according to this story, revenue is up in Hollywood. So I don't know. I don't think this is the right time to be raising prices. What do you think?
That sounds like newspaper, doesn't it? readership is down. Let's make up for it by raising our cost. Yeah,
exactly.
I find that very interesting, and it kind of ties into something I've got here. Out of New York, it's basically the headline is now playing at Blockbuster, Catch-22. Blockbuster finally has a point of differentiation to advertise. Do they really? I'm surprised. And strong creative to engage customers. But it may not have the money to invest in marketing. That's a problem. The Blockbuster spot, 28 days, ran in Charlotte for about 6 weeks. It introduced the tagline, less waiting, more watching. Basically, they have until the end of the month, this month, to pay back $42 million of its $1 billion in debt. And the Los Angeles Times reporting that the company is considering bankruptcy. At the same time, it's been testing creative around three different themes in Charlotte, Reno, Columbus, Ohio as well. Here's the thing. The most interesting thing is creative touting Blockbuster's ability to deliver new releases 28 days before their big rivals, and I do mean big rivals, Netflix and Redbox. The deal only applies to Universal, Fox, and Warner Brothers, but Blockbuster has said it has been a boon for business. 28 days, you can get them before being released. So I guess that is an edge, but you know, when you think about Blockbuster as a whole, and you think about the ease and convenience and affordability of the competition, as Netflix is and as Redbox is, they're everywhere. I don't see Blockbuster going with anything but a bankruptcy-type move. And after that, I don't see Blockbuster rebounding from that. I think it's just another one of those businesses that used to be a really, really, really good idea when it need, you know, when the need was there. But I think it's beyond the need right now. I mean, think of all the other things, how we can get a product. You know, beyond going to the movies, which is, as you say, kind of a ridiculously expensive proposition. But, you know, Redbox and Netflix, they have something going. Blockbuster, the 28 days thing, that sounds like a the Cash for Clunkers program, if you know what I'm saying.
It's a differentiator, but unfortunately, it's a differentiator, I think, that A, has not all that great of value to the consumer, and B, is coming a little late in late innings here. I mean, everybody thinks of Netflix, and then, with, of course, with the iPad and being able to download movies directly to your iPad from Netflix, they're too late to be trying to look for a differentiator that, again, holds, I think, little value to the general consuming public that's out there, acquiring movies through Netflix and Redbox, as you say.
On the Advertising Show, Ray Schillings, Brad Forsyth, about to talk to Jay Green out of Seattle. Right now, we're going to talk to Jeremy Kent, our European correspondent on the Advertising Show. Always something interesting we find here, and let's listen to that right now.
Hello and welcome to the European News Desk. I'm Jeremy Kent. Coming up, Gucci's guilty viral, Kellogg and Nestle complain, and online videos aren't engaging the viewers. Gucci Guilty is Gucci's biggest fragrance so far, and the Italian brand is using a mix of viral and social media to launch it. Riccardo Rowini from REM Rome has produced a 60-second cinema spot. Digital was created by Amsterdam's tribal DDB, and seeding was by the Seventh Chamber. Starring Evan Rachel Wood and the Fantastic Four's Chris Evans, the ad was directed by Frank Miller of Sin City fame. Depeche Mode's Strangelove plays in the background as Evan Rachel Wood blasts through the black and white city landscape in a classic 1953 Jaguar C-Type. It's well shot and very cool. Channel 4 is one of the UK's major free-to-air TV channels. Its long-running and well-respected Dispatches programme is a hard-hitting documentary series, and in October 2009 it showed an episode called What's in Your Breakfast? The programme looked into nutritional content of breakfast products and how they are marketed to the British public. Nestlé's Shreddies and Kellogg's Corn Flakes and Rice Krispies were all named in the programme. Nestlé and Kellogg's went on to strongly complain about the programme to the UK regulator, Ofcom. Both companies claimed that the programme had treated them unfairly and that they hadn't been given the right to respond to allegations. Kellogg in particular objected to its portrayal as a company that deliberately targeted kids with marketing, as well as claims that it was shoveling sugar into children. In response, Ofcom rejected all the claims made by both companies. It found that neither of them had been unfairly treated and that the programme makers weren't required to give either company an opportunity to respond. Having started this bulletin with Gucci's online campaign, a new survey for Deloitte claims that online video ads have less impact than other forms of advertising. The consumer survey asked respondents to name the three types of advertising that had the greatest impact on them. Ads contained within mobile apps were mentioned the least at just 1%, 3% said online video, and 4% said banners. However, it's the traditional media channels that remain the big hitters, with TV claiming 56% and newspapers 30%. But worryingly, 26% of people claimed that none of the channels had an impact. From London, this is Jeremy Kent for The Advertising Show.
Thank you, Jeremy Kent, our European correspondent on The Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. As we said, Jay Green is with us out of Seattle. And it's a brand new book that Jay has that we're going to talk about. And, of course, we're going to talk about more. Design is how it works. But Jay, it is certainly a pleasure to have you here at The Advertising Show today. Welcome.
Thanks, Ray. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Ray and I were talking about your book, Jay. And I got to tell you, business books come either in the form of people within the industry writing their opinion, philosophy, whatever. And then there are journalists like yourself that write about subject matter in the business sector, if you will. And in a lot of cases, journalists sometimes don't really connect well, at least from my perspective, on the topic at hand. Yet your book, I might add, on portfolio, I thought, and Ray agreed, is an exceptional read. You obviously have done your homework. It's a great book. I can't recommend it enough to our listeners. And I'd like to ask you, since Ray already mentioned you were former Business Week Seattle bureau chief, you've been a writer your entire life. So why is this your first book and why now?
Well, first of all, thanks, Brad, so much for the kind words. I appreciate it. You know, it's my first book because the opportunity presented itself. I've been writing about design for a while, and it's a fascinating topic to me. And, you know, I'd written a piece for Business Week about Bang & Olufsen, which is the high-end audio equipment maker in Denmark, and I went to Denmark and visited with those guys and talked about their design process. And the good folks at Portfolio, at my publisher, emailed me and said, hey, you should be thinking about doing a book on this topic. And so I did.
Good.
And what came from that article? What year was that? Did the article appear?
I think it was October 2007, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, what did you learn from that article? Anything exciting in the design world?
Yeah, you know, Bang & Olufsen has a fascinating design process. What they've chosen to do is they have designers outside of the company. They don't have designers inside. They contract with, you know, these designers who make these wonderful products for them. And I mean, they're beautiful, and they hang, you know, in the Museum of Modern Art. I mean, they're terrific-looking products. And they have them as outsiders because they don't want them to get involved in the internal politics of the company. They don't want an engineer to sit down and try and browbeat them over lunch and tell them to tweak their designs just a little bit to make it, you know, a bit easier, because they don't want to short-circuit the beauty of the product. And it's an interesting idea, and it's worked for a number of years for Bang & Olufsen. But one of the interesting things is, in the last couple of years, Bang & Olufsen struggled, because as much as effort as they put on the sort of fit and finish of the product, they actually don't work all that hard, or hadn't worked all that hard, on how the product works and how consumers experience the product. And so if I learned anything, it's that fit and finish is great. It's table stakes. But if you don't have a product that meets consumers' needs and helps develop a great experience for consumers, it ain't going to work.
You know, that's interesting. And you talk about that particular company seeking design outside of its own walls, yet there are many companies where would never consider design input from outside their company walls. Yet there are other companies like Lego, for example, that rely heavily on market research. As much as many business gurus might like to gin up a one-size-fits-all strategy when it comes to innovation and so forth, there really isn't one when it comes to design, is there, Jay?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right what you're saying. There isn't one. And it's one of the toughest things for executives to really get their heads around. You know, everybody loves to look at Apple as the sort of design poster child of the day. And, you know, Apple's strategy has been dissected and pulled apart and reconstituted to try and fit other companies' needs. And the fact is, Apple is as successful as it is because it does things that fit its specific niche. It's led by, you know, a guy who cares deeply about design. It has another guy, Jonathan Ive, who is the head of design at the company, who is brilliant. It has a sort of the market niche of being a tech company going up against a couple other big tech companies that have sort of shied away from design. And so what Apple does is great for Apple, but the fact is there are a lot of other companies that I write about in this book that take entirely different approaches and are very successful as well.
You know, it seems like the automotive industry has been a sufferer of a lack of connecting design into a product that may work, and I think that has hurt, you know, the American brands like General Motors and so on and so forth. But it seems like the light all of a sudden went on here, and somebody said we got to make these cars look like our counterparts that are selling like gangbusters. How important is that in the overall scheme of things as it relates to the automotive industry?
Well, the automotive industry is fascinating to me, and I spent a chapter looking at Porsche and its design process, and I got to go to Stuttgart and meet with the guys there, and then I went to their test track in Leipzig and got to race a 911 around the track.
Sweet.
And it was really fun. But what's interesting about Porsche is they really focus on the experience that people have. And, nothing at Porsche comes by accident. And so if you think about Porsche, they look beautiful, but they perform extraordinarily well. The sound of the engine is right. The layout of the dashboard is right. The cars do exactly what you want them to do. And so they really focus on the experience. And I'll say they do it a lot better than most of the American car makers. And it's a sad thing for the American auto industry that they haven't been as ingenious as their European and Asian rivals. There's some efforts to try and change that, and some American automakers that are doing some interesting things these days. But it's a tough slog for them right now.
I'd love to get your take on one thing. There's now a flying car, a legitimate flying car that is going to be marketed. It's called a Terra Fugia, or Fugia, or however they pronounce it there. And they've tested it. It's actually potentially going to fly at $200,000 as a light sport aircraft. And the design of that thing has evolved a little bit. Are you familiar, or have you heard anything about that? It's kind of cool.
I haven't heard anything about it, but it makes me think of George Jetson. I love it.
It's exactly what George Jetson does, and it's a reality. And if you've got $10,000 to plunk down, you can reserve yourself one. But design of the car definitely is cool, and obviously it has to be functional as well, too, as you said.
Yeah, and I mean, gosh, go down the road. I mean, you start worrying about things like safety and all those other things that you need to address those points as well. But, power to them. I suspect there's a market out there.
And they have. Brad, go ahead.
Yeah, staying with Porsche for a second, you mentioned the left-hand ignition and vertical dashboard. I think everybody recognizes that Porsche certainly has a distinctive design. And as you mentioned in your book, and you just mentioned earlier, nothing of this comes by accident. I think a lot of people, Jay, when they think of great design, they think of the wow factor, yet in many cases, distinctive design is a lot more subtle than that. Talk about how companies can capitalize on their product nuances, incorporate this in their brand design.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the points I've made in the book, and I really want to make with you guys and others, is that design isn't that glossy sheen at the end. I mean, that helps, but design is how a product works. So let's talk about a company I read about in the book called Clif Bar. So they make energy bars for athletes. Now, there's no one who would think of a Clif Bar product as hanging on the walls of the Museum of Modern Art anytime soon, right? They aren't particularly attractive products. But what's interesting is that they use the same tools that designers use to create their products. They do ethnographic research on their customers. They prototype, and they do sort of rapid prototyping where they try one thing and it doesn't work and they try another. It's not a fit and finish kind of prototype. It's something that happens very quickly. They do all these sorts of things that designers do when they craft a product that you and I might think of as being beautiful, but Clif Bar does it in a way that makes their customers really crave their products. And they come up with novel new products that folks hadn't considered before. And so I'll give you just a really quick example, but one of them is the Luna Bar. And that's Clif Bar's product that's targeted specifically for women. And you might sit there and think, well, gosh, what's the big difference between an energy bar for a man or a woman? It turns out when Clif Bar first came out, a number of women chatted with them and said, it's a great product, but it has too many calories for me. I'm a smaller person. I don't need as many calories. And Clif Bar took that and sort of thought about it. How could they come up with a bar that was really specifically targeted towards women? They came up with the Luna Bar. What's interesting, it has lower calories. It also has more folic acid and more iron. And, those are things that women really desire in a product. And the Luna Bar has not only taken off, it has done so without hurting Cliff Bar at all. It didn't cannibalize sales even a bit. And it's fascinating, but it's using design thinking to create a product in a business where you wouldn't necessarily think design actually could play a role.
On the Advertising Show, Jay Green is the author of a brand new book called Design is How It Works, and we'll continue our conversation here in just a moment. Stay right here.
You're listening to The Advertising Show with Ray Schillins and Brad Forsyth.
Never borrow money needlessly, just when you must.
Well, there's a definite blast from our advertising past, an HFC commercial. My goodness, haven't heard that in a long time. Ray Schillins and Brad Forsyth on the Advertising Show with our very special guest out of Seattle. What a beautiful area of the country it is. Design is how it works. I guess you had some contribution there, Jay, as well as in the design of your wonderful city, because obviously that's a cool place too, huh?
It's a great place to be. It's inspirational.
There you go.
You know, I think when we think of great design, we think of like the iPod, and Apple did a great job in launching that product. You mentioned Porsche last segment, another great innovative product that has a wonderful brand and a beautiful design, but yet a product that was also marketed extensively. Talk a little bit about the role that design plays in marketing. And, of course, I guess we all have to keep in mind nothing will kill a poor product quicker than great advertising. So the question is, can great design, Jay, replace the need for effective marketing?
Well, I think they work hand in hand. So replace may be too strong. But certainly companies that do great design use that design to help market the product. So let's use an example here. Another company I write about in the book is OXO, and they make kitchen products. And other things, and they're really cool-looking products. One of the products I think is really neat that they make is something, it's called an angled measuring cup. And some of your listeners may have used these or even have them in their kitchen. But, you know, they're measuring cups, and they have sort of a little shelf inside that's angled downwards so that as you're filling it with liquid, you can look into the measuring cup and know exactly how much you have in there. With the traditional kind of Pyrex measuring cup that people have in their kitchens, you fill it a little bit, you lift the cup up, you look at the side, you realize you put in too much, you tip a little bit out, and you get the amount you want. But what's interesting about OXO is they don't do much in the way of advertising, and actually they don't do much in the way of packaging. They try and allow their products to speak for themselves. And so when you go to Bed Bath & Beyond or wherever it is you may buy that product, all of a sudden you look on the shelf and you see the product and you know exactly what it does. And it's because of the design. And so it's a really interesting thing where the design itself is carrying the marketing of the product.
So I'd like to get your thoughts on where consumers today influence the design of a product that they happen to like. Some companies embrace this concept. Others would never consider allowing a consumer to have influence over their product design. What are your thoughts on that?
So it's a really interesting question. It's a really interesting question, and there are a couple of things to think about. Consumers getting involved in the design of a product can be great. They have terrific insights. So another company I write about extensively in the book is Lego. And there was a time a few years ago when Lego wanted to update its Mindstorms product. And that's the robotics product that it's created. And it was enormously popular when it came out in the first generation. It was time for Lego to update it. And so what they did is they actually reached out to their most hardcore robotics users. And these are adults, not kids, but adults who use these products, and they said, what would you like to see in the next one? And they actually invited them into the design process. Now, Lego didn't take every suggestion these folks had, but what it did do is it used these extreme users, these folks who know the product better than almost everyone, and it used their advice to help shape the next generation of the product. And the lesson in that is that the most hardcore users often can put into words what should be in a product in a way that the rest of us can't. Now, the danger is that most consumers don't really know what they want. And that may sound a little bit odd, but let's think about the iPhone for a second. I have one. I love it. It's a great phone. And trust me, there are a whole bunch of other people who love their iPhones too. But if you flash backwards to the pre-iPhone era and you said to folks, help us figure out what the coolest new phone would be, I think you wouldn't find anyone who would have said, oh, we really want a touchscreen phone that can connect seamlessly up to the Internet so I can download any one of 250,000 applications to personalize my particular phone. And yet that's what Apple has given us. And they knew that that would be something that consumers would want, even though not a single consumer was specifically asking for that.
That's a very good point. I'm wondering if timing has something to do with that, or is that really design? Is it marketing? I think it's probably a combination of all those things, isn't it, Jay?
I'm sure it is. Yeah, and you know, I would say timing has less to do with it than the design and the marketing of it. You know, it was the right product at the right time, but that's a little bit of an aphorism and maybe a little too simplistic. I think it came out at a good time for that product to come out, but it was really a great design that lured folks to that phone.
You know, as we wrap up this segment, just another final question on OXO you mentioned. And by the way, great case studies throughout the book. You feature, I think it's 8 different companies, and taking each company and showing where they innovate through design and so forth. You had a great example of OXO in their what's called their Good Grips staple remover. And it also had kind of a consideration with regard to both price point as well as innovative design. Talk a little bit about that, Jay.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's actually one of my favorite products. I have one on my desk right here. So most staple removers, everybody knows these kind of two-fanged removers that you clip on the staple to pull out. And everybody knows that when you do that, you're going to rip some of the paper. All right, so it's a pet peeve. Most people just deal with it because that's what we got. OXO's whole business is about finding those pet peeves and trying to solve them. And so it worked at trying to figure out how to create a staple remover that would remove those staples without tearing the paper. And it tinkered with a whole bunch of different designs, and a few of them didn't work. Some of them came close and didn't work. And they finally came up with one that is, I think it's a pretty cool product. It almost looks like a letter opener, but it's a maybe 2 or 3 inch piece of metal that tapers gradually outward and gradually thicker, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so what you do is you stick it under the staple, and it as you push it under the staple bends outward and upward and then pops out of the paper. The paper doesn't ever rip. It's a really fascinating and innovative design. But here's the interesting thing. It sells for about 3 times as much as those regular staple removers that tear your paper, and you know what? People are buying them. It's one of the best-selling products that OXO has in its office business line. And it's doing well because, again, design is how it works.
It's a new mousetrap here, isn't it? It's Jay Green here with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth on The Advertising Show. Design is how it works. JayGreen.com, by the way, is Jay's website. And we'll talk more with Jay here in just a moment on The Advertising Show, being powered by Shipple.com. Shipple is an incredibly powerful marketing tool as it relates to your web presence through a platform called Tendency, and they've got a whole bunch of other stuff out there as well that is killer. Check it out. It's SCHIPOL.com. Ray and Brad back with more with Jay Green. Welcome back to The Advertising Show with Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. And this is important, too, as we relate to Jay Green's website. It has an E on the end of it, okay? So it's just not G-R-E-E-N. It's G-R-E-E-N-E. He paid the extra price and got the extra E. I think it's a wonderful idea. And from a design standpoint, I guess it makes sense, doesn't it, Jay?
There you go. And now you can even add that J is actually J-A-Y, just so that we don't confuse anyone out there.
That's true, and www is exactly what it means, too, as well.
Exactly right.
There you go. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
And by the way, Jay has a type A blood, just in case anyone was wondering. you know, Jay, I think a lot of people think of design mostly in physical terms, yet I'm curious, is it possible for a product to look bad yet work well enough to save it?
Oh, absolutely. And again, you know, I mentioned the Clif Bar thing, right? I mean, Clif Bar is a product that doesn't look particularly good, but it works terrific. They actually do exactly what the athletes who use those products want them to do. Or another way you even think about this is, let's think about services, right? I mean, there are companies that design services that have no appearance at all. You know, one of the ones I use in the book is Virgin Atlantic, right? They design air travel. And folks love it. And think about that for a second. In this era when people hate flying, mm-hmm. and, you know, airlines are pilloried for charging, you know, flyers to rent a pillow or, eat, you know, they give terrible food. people love flying on Virgin Atlantic, and it's because they design a service that customers really crave. And they do it with whimsy and with charm. I mean, you know, they do everything from creating 14 different lighting settings to create the right mood, to even silly things like they have their cutlery is kind of amusing. They have the cheese knife that you get in first class when you fly on Virgin Atlantic. And in it is etched the words, finest stainless steel, and steel is spelled S-T-E-A-L. That's just terrific marketing. You'd sit there and you think, well, do they want me to steal that thing?
Yep.
And the answer is yes. Nice. They want you to take it home, and then they want you to show it up to their friends.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and they did it because they were losing these knives anyway. So they figured, roll with it. Let's have fun with it and maybe give folks you know, a sense of fun and a reason to laugh about all this stuff.
I could just see somebody at Virgin Atlantic going, yeah, be sure and put the website on there so that people know where to go and, you know, when they find it at home. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
In your book, Jay, you stress throughout your book that design isn't just about rebranding. I'm curious, do you think that most people in the corporate world confuse the two, rebranding and innovative design?
And I would even take it a step farther and say I think most executives don't really get what design is. I think most executives think of design as being that sheen you put on at the end of the process. And I think it's because CEOs generally don't come up through design ranks. CEOs generally come up through finance ranks. And they're guys who understand balance sheets, and they understand benchmarking. And you know, their training isn't in design. And design is next to impossible to benchmark. It isn't something that CEOs are typically comfortable with. And so it's easier for them to just sort of say, yeah, it's about rebranding. Let's just do it that way.
You know, that's interesting. How does one create a culture of innovation and design within the corporate environment? I would think that, you know, design is something that a lot of bean counters and certainly people out of the finance end of a company would be hesitant to back because there's no metrics that say, okay, let's be innovative and run it through a test and know that if we put this kind of money into design that we're going to realize this kind of return on our investment. How do you create that kind of environment where design takes a forefront position within a corporate structure?
And what you're saying is exactly right, Nick. It is the big challenge in corporate America and really but other cultures as well to try and get design to take hold, to take root in a company. It really has to come from the top down in many ways. The CEOs have to accept that design is an important part of the process. And part of that means embracing risk. And CEOs love to say, oh, yeah, well, we take risks. Many of them don't. Risks often mean failure. And all of the companies I write in the book have had failures, and I mentioned some of them in the book. Failures, and when you fail, these companies, they don't sweep it under the rug and say, oh, gosh, we failed. Let's be quiet about that. They actually celebrate it, and that may sound kind of funny, but companies talk about their failures so that they can learn from them. And then they actually talk about them widely. They talk about them to guys like me, to journalists who they wouldn't normally, you know, want people to write negative things about the company. But, you know, when a product fails, there's tons you can learn from it, and you know, executives have to be willing to accept those sorts of failures and give their employees the latitude to fail, because if they don't, they're never going to succeed in the big ways that design can allow them to.
Yeah, just in the minute and a half we have left in this segment, speaking of metrics and instincts and so forth, does tuition trump market research when it comes to initially evaluating innovative design concepts, you think?
I would say so. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with market research, and market research can help you, particularly in terms of marketing the product. In terms of developing the product, it's a bit harder, because as I said earlier, you know, consumers don't often know what they want. And one of the biggest challenges for design at companies is what I call the prove-it culture. Often when executives want to develop a product, their bosses will say, prove it. Show me that this product will work. Well, you couldn't have asked Apple to prove that the iPhone was going to work because a touchscreen phone didn't exist at the time. You know, there are any number of products in here. I mean, I talk about OXO. OXO develops all the, you know, the staple remover. No one could prove that that product was going to be as successful as it was because it cost so much more than the other ones. So intuition matters a lot in these businesses, and market research can't replace that.
And with that said, go out and take a risk and buy the book. That's a good risk to take. Design is how it works. Jay Green is the author of the book. Jay, it has been a pleasure having you here at the Advertising Show today.
Brad Ray, thank you so much for having me.
On the Advertising Show, we've got more to come in just a moment, so stay right here. Our thanks again to Jay Green, our special guest today here at the Advertising Show. Ray Shillings, Brad Forsyth. Always great shows coming up in the future, and what we'd like to do is have you talk about it. Tell your friends about the Advertising Show. That old word of mouth works well for us, if you know what I'm saying. Here's a brand new kind of a title, a role you can get into, Brad. Not you necessarily. It's called the Chief Listener. it's something new. It's a chief listener. Evokes images of fuzzy sweaters, chamomile tea, and sitting around with a patient ear instead of try sifting through unstructured data and building complex queries. They say basically, here's a scenario. This is out of Ad Age, and it says, we get about 300,000 new mentions of Kodak every month, and we don't censor the comments or the videos people create about our company, says Beth LaPierre, Kodak's Chief Listening Officer, CLO, a role that is just starting to crop up in a few major marketing organizations. It involves decidedly non-touchy-feely tasks. She says she spent the past 5 months defining how we handle those data via technology and tools. The big task is data mining and figuring out who needs the information. So what they're doing here is they're digging deep, the mining part, and what they're suggesting is they bring this information to the marketing team and the product team and bring it all together. And, for example, she sends commentary about features and product requests to a product development team and so forth. Her counterpart, Dell chief listener Susan Beebe, describes her job, which started in July, as building complex queries. There is data analysis research role to this job, and she says she's got a very technical background. So, as I said before, if you're new to the biz and you really want to tap into something here, it seems like the chief listening officer is somebody who will become, as technology continues to evolve, a very integral and very important part of what you could do as it relates to advertising and marketing. A CLO, a CLO. Yep.
You know, how many years have we interviewed executives and others that have, both on the client side as well as on the agency side, that have said, you know, the key is listening to your customers, and they'll tell you both the good, bad, and ugly. And by listening to them, do you find out what you need to do in terms of refining your product, mm-hmm. your service? Same with marketing. So I'm glad to hear that they're finally getting around to having someone in charge of this at the corporate level. Ray, I found this interesting. Major League Baseball is allowing Google's YouTube to show full-length games in Japan. The deal signals a closer relationship with one of the world's most successful sports leagues. YouTube's users in Japan will be able to watch current games with a 36-hour delay. So I thought that was...
That's kind of cool.
Innovation for Major League Baseball has to take place in Japan. I don't know why they don't do that here.
Well, just because, you know. Yeah, a lot of things come from that country as well. So thanks to our guest today again, Jay Green, and tune in next week, okay? We'll hope you will be right here when we're on the air with the Advertising Show. It's being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. Visit them online at adage.com. Ray Shillings and Brad Forsyth. The Advertising Show is a copyrighted Big Radio Midgets production.
Under pressure? Get creative concepts fast. Run a global pitch on openad.net and gain access to a global brain trust of nearly 11,000 advertising and marketing creators from 125 countries. Simply take 15 minutes to fill out our online brief form and we'll take care of the rest. From world-class agencies to the best independents to the brightest freelancers, openad.net global creatives can deliver creative concepts direct to your desktop in a matter of days. Why not save time, energy, and money by quickly sourcing concepts from the world's brightest creative minds? Visit openad.net and see how we're revolutionizing the way ideas are created and traded. It's simple, it's fast, and it's global. Openad.net, the smarter way to create your advertising from the freshest creative minds on the planet. visit openad.net today to find out more.